You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chad McMatlin, and with me in the studio to my right, Neil Payne.
Hey, Chad.
Hi, Neil. And Kate Fagan.
Hi, Chad.
Kate, of course, ESPNW columnist, Neil, sports writer for 538. We've been doing this so long, guys, I forgot.
No more tags.
Yeah. Forgot to introduce who you were. But we have new listeners.
We don't believe in labels.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
No labels here.
On today's show, we'll do round two of our Pacquiao-Mayweather discussion now that the fight has actually happened. Then we'll gab about round two of the NBA playoffs. And we'll talk to Harry Pavlidis of Baseball Prospectus to find out how sabermetrics get made. And of course, we'll have Allison McCann with our significant digit. This week, it's about soccer. But first, Jody Avergan is back with an update on our crowdsourced NBA draft project.
Hi. To recap for people who are listening for the first time, we are asking folks for their ideas for how to fix the NBA draft and stop tanking in the NBA. And we posted a form online and got almost 7,000 submissions. I am slogging my way through these submissions. I'm going to try and read basically all of them. And next week, on next week's show, you three, the panel, are going to talk about some of our favorites. But today, I wanted to offer a little update on the very non-serious proposals that we've been getting. We've been getting a number of them, including what I think is probably the fan favorite thus far, which is an idea from Bob in New Orleans about how to fix the NBA lottery. And he writes in – actually, Kate, do you want to read this for us?
Read
all
it.
Right, here you go.
Sight unseen here.
Yeah.
Happening.
Okay, Kate.
Do we
this
know
my
Bob
first
is a Pelicans time through. Fan or anything? We don't know
anything about Bob other than he's a genius.
Okay. Bob from New Orleans.
This is his plan.
Each team is required to bring a fish to the lottery ceremony. Each one has to be a different species. Parentheses, salmon, tuna, etc., and release it into a pool. Then Adam Silver will ride a bear into the pool, and the fish that the bear eats first wins the lottery. If the bear eats Adam Silver, then it goes by worst record first.
This is a foolproof plan. I would watch this. We can call it the tank. You know, when you take into account the fact that it's happening in the spring when the bears are coming out of hibernation, they're particularly hungry. I really think it adds a sense of danger. That said, I am not sure if Bob has thought through all the implications. For instance, what kind of bear is it? Do the teams get to choose what kind of bear or what kind of fish? Because I think this could severely affect the draft lottery. And Neil, I know you've actually done some research into this.
That's right. Yeah, I ran some numbers. The last 15 spring seasons along the rivers of the Yukon Territory and other wilderness areas. And it's pretty striking. For instance, if the bear is an Alaskan grizzly bear, there's a 74% chance that it will eat the salmon first. If you end up with a polar bear, you better hope there's an Arctic char or a four-horned sculpin somewhere in that pond. And Mexican grizzly bears, which are technically brown bears, they don't even eat much fish. It's just mostly fruits and berries. So you'd be out of luck.
So there's lots of ripple effects from this plan. I think we still need to run some of the numbers. I mean, what if you end up with a panda? That's technically a bear.
What if it's a Memphis Grizzly? This thing can easily be rigged for Memphis to get the number one pick, I'd argue.
But if it's a koala, that's actually like a marsupial. I just want to let people know.
Right.
Don't get caught up
international expansion for the NBA.
Don't get caught up thinking that's a bear. It's not. People will let you know it's a marsupial.
So think about the slogans that fans could get into. There's obviously tank for the tank. There's a pout for the trout, suffer for the puffer. I am into this plan. I think it could work. I think it would get incredible ratings.
This also sounds like some sort of dystopian young adult novel happening here, by the way.
Hunger Games needs a new sequel. They're
NBA
running out
version.
Of book material.
Yeah.
So we have rounded up on the site. The post will go up tomorrow, Wednesday, if you're listening to it tomorrow on Wednesday. Some of our favorite weirder ideas. So it's we have Bob's along with about five or six other kind of crazy plans. And I think we can reveal that we actually have commissioned a photo illustration of this plan. So I've seen a preliminary version of this, but it will be on the site of Adam Silver riding a bear into a tank full of fish. So go to the website tomorrow, 538.com. Read some of these sillier plans. See the full spreadsheet of all the 7,000 ideas we've gotten. And then, of course, stay tuned. Next week, we'll talk about some of the more serious ideas.
Great. Thanks, Jody.
Thank you.
Last Saturday, rather than ride into the ring on a grizzly bear, Manny Pacquiao came out with Jimmy Kimmel. Floyd Mayweather came out with the Burger King slogan. That's mascot.
Yes.
And Mayweather beat Manny Pacquiao in front of what seemed like every celebrity that happened to be in Vegas that day or commuted for it.
Or in Tom Brady's case, celebrities who had also been in Kentucky earlier that day.
And the tarmac of planes in Vegas was absurd. I don't know if you saw a picture of it, but it was like puzzle pieces of like planes.
Private jets or something?
Yeah, and all different angles. Like they could barely fit all.
They were trying to take in the greatest sporting day ever, which is something we may talk about in a bit. But the point is that Mayweather beat Pacquiao in a unanimous decision, but it was a decision, not a knockout. It was after weeks of hype. It was all over in an hour or two. It seemed almost like an amusement park ride where you're sort of waiting in line and you're getting sort of everything's getting really amped and all of a sudden it's over and you're wondering why you waited in line that long in the first place. And so last week we talked about the political and the cultural impact of the fight. And so this week, let's talk about the sporting elements of it. As I said, Mayweather won by unanimous decision, except for Manny Pacquiao, who was not unanimous in the decision. Here's Manny's self-interested hot take right after the fight.
It's a good fight. I thought I won the fight.
You thought you won the fight? Why?
He didn't do nothing. He always, move outside. I got him many times, I saw the passes, and I thought I won the fight.
So guys, was Pacquiao right? Did he deserve to win that fight?
I don't think so. Like, I don't think anyone who watched the fight would have said that Pacquiao won, but it could just be a kind of a residue of the way Floyd Mayweather fights, which is to not let people hit him. So defensively, certainly Mayweather is, maybe one of, if not the best, one of the best of all time. But it was almost all defense for him. And Pacquiao was on the offensive. And as we later learned, he was nursing a shoulder injury. But really, Pacquiao is sort of right when he said that he didn't get hit that much because the boxing stats say otherwise, but a lot of those were just jabs by Mayweather, and that's what Mayweather does so great, is just float around and not let people hit him. But that also kind of calls into question, what does it really mean to win a boxing match?
Yeah, that's the part I walked away with was, yes, Floyd Mayweather won by the laws and the rules of boxing. I mean, you can't dispute that when you look at number of punches thrown, number of punches landed, percentage of punches.
And so some of those numbers, so they threw about the same number of punches, 435 for Mayweather, 429 for Pacquiao. The connection, the connect percent, as I'm seeing on this stat readout, was 34% for Mayweather, 34% of his punches landed, 19%. For Pacquiao. So there really was a disparity in,
right,
as far as connection goes.
Yeah, and the interesting part was that when you looked at Mayweather's total punches landed, a lot of people correctly pointed out that he was getting credit for that sort of pawing motion he was making the whole time, where it wasn't even like a connected punch that would have knocked Manny back. It was just sort of like a love tap, and he was just racking those up. So of course you walk away thinking, all right, well, he didn't lose the fight. That's what I kind of think. Like, did he win the fight? He didn't really do anything that was aggressively offensive trying to win the fight, but he just didn't lose the fight. But he also seems to have built his whole career on having found the sweet spot of boxing's rules and how to exploit them. And to me, as I was reading about it, it was kind of like, do we like it when, we hack Shaq in a basketball game or DeAndre Jordan? Have you exploited the rule and is in the pure interest of the sport? No, but until the rules change, that Floyd did win the boxing match. Now, if you want to introduce some sort of like boxing shot clock or change the rules in terms of what a punch landed is, well, then his game no longer fits and wins in boxing. But the way it is, it does.
And to me, where the tension is here is between quantitative sort of dominance and like aesthetic dominance, if we can put it in that framework, which is to say that it wasn't pretty, it seemed, to watch the way Mayweather fought, and we talked last week or the week before about cynical play. I forget what we were talking about. I think it was in the NBA.
James Harden.
Oh, yeah, about James Harden. You know, Mayweather was asked to go win the fight. However he goes to win that fight is fine. What's different in boxing is it's not just about the final score, because there is subjectivity in the judging, right? In the in basketball, it's clear. Number of points that go in, that are tallied, the number of baskets that go through the hoop. In boxing, there is a bit of wiggle room, and that's where the aesthetic part maybe does have more of a place in whether or not somebody is a good boxer, quote unquote, than basketball, whether or not James Harden is a good basketball player.
Yeah, and as a lot of people pointed out, when you're supposedly when the judges are sitting courtside, it's hard for them to know which punches connected. I mean, they're just keeping a tally of like punches. And in that regard, what Manny did get in some did hurt Floyd in a way that he hasn't been hurt before. If you take in like a flush punch, which he does not absorb many of those, but it seems like Floyd knows that just making the motion of punching in a lot of ways accumulates punches thrown, and not necessarily always like impact punches thrown.
And I mean, let's not get it wrong. Mayweather, just subjectively from watching the fight, he controlled the fight, but a lot of that seems to rest with like his potential to do damage, but he doesn't actually do it. There was a great point made by Drew McGarry at Deadspin where he likened Mayweather's boxing style to a neutral zone trap hockey team, where it's a calculated strategy, like you said, Kate, and trying to get credit for punches. And then also he carries himself in a way, and it probably had a lot to do with his length advantage. He had the longer reach, that he wasn't really threatened by what Pacquiao was doing, and he seemed like if Pacquiao had opened himself up to go for broke on a punch, that he could have ended the fight. But at the end of the day, that's really just a hypothetical, and it seems like a lot of these Mayweather fights exercise more in the hypothetical of how good he looks and how much in control he seems to be of the fight, but it never really actually means anything necessarily.
But again, he's fighting against someone else, right? And so he's customizing his strategy, presumably, to his opponent, the same way as a team does all the time when a team faces another. If that's what's going to win him the match for whatever reason, because he is going to wait for the opponent to open up and then maybe bring a more powerful punch in, then that still seems to me like he's doing his job well and deserves to win. I don't see the
yeah, I think the disconnect comes in like the optics for the majority of people who watch the fight. Mm-hmm. Because, again, I don't have numbers. I don't know if we know what percentage of people who watch this fight like don't usually watch boxing, but it seems like a lot
probably
of people, let's just say statistically a lot, quote unquote, of people tuned in who maybe don't know the intricacies of Floyd Mayweather's boxing style as well as Manny's. So they just think of boxing as a fight, like two guys going at it. But if you really knew the narrative of these two guys coming in, you knew that they were both older and that they both had different styles of games that were different than just like knockout boxers like Mike Tyson. So I kind of liken this, like if we'd seen like Michael Jordan play one-on-one against Gary Payton in the later part of their careers, and all of a sudden Michael Jordan is like, using sort of jab steps and fadeaway jumpers, and you're annoyed that he's not going to the rim and dunking. I mean, this is what the fight was. It was two older guys who had devised systems and ways of fighting and also tailored those seemingly as they get older to be even smarter. But it wasn't a fight, like an all-out fight like we see in Hollywood. But you have all these people tuning in who all they know about boxing for the most part is like a Rocky fight where you just have passion and guys trying to knock each other out. But that's never what this was. And so there's a disconnect between the reality of what the fight was and what we thought we would see in boxing.
Right. And what was interesting, too, is that right after the fight, it seemed like there was a conversation about when or whether a rematch would happen.
Right.
As though, like, the last 3 months of our lives sort of had been...
3 months? 5 years?
Right, yeah. Had been sort of leading up just to now be a sequel, which I guess is the same way that Hollywood works, and we saw that in Rocky 1, 2, 3, 4, et cetera. But now Pacquiao just had rotator, or is going to have rotator cuff surgery, is going to be, quote, out for 9 to 12 months. I think that's a funny phrase when you're a boxer and maybe don't fight for a lot of that anyway. But Mayweather texted Stephen A. Smith ESPN, Stephen A. Smith, to say that he would indeed fight Mayweather in a year after he fight Pacquiao in a year after he had recovered. This seems to me to be part of the problem of boxing. Mm-hmm. It's like even when we have this this event that culminates this long saga, as you said, 5 years worth of narrative, that still it's never. There's always something more. That mm-hmm. there is never finality to anything. And does this get at maybe why boxing is having a hard time?
They consistently break the social agreement of, like, we have committed our time and our resources to see this, what we think, an organic, authentic moment between two athletes. Like, boxing is constantly messing with us on that. So, like, I watched the fight thinking, hoping it was two fighters like going after it, but it all now feels premeditated. Maybe I'm being naive, but
so what's the difference? So when the Spurs and the Heat faced each other again in the finals, I was excited. It was a rematch, right? Was it because they had earned their way there or something? What's the difference? Is it because things are organized? I'm just trying to understand why.
There's no overlap between like the motivation of like the Clippers and the Spurs first round. I know you mentioned the Clippers and the Heat, but the only motivation they have is to get to the second round. In that moment, there were all these extra motivations at play with Mayweather and Pacquiao, like setting up the potential for a rematch, which means that the authentic moment we're paying for is diluted by their future considerations, which is not how sports are supposed to work. That's what's so frustrating, is when we're already talking about a rematch. So why did we pay $100 to watch this, what we thought was this seminal moment in sporting history, if really it was just a premeditated setup to a rematch?
Right, so without the tournament sort of framework around it, the way that you might have in the Olympics for boxing or something, that there's too many long-term considerations that maybe overwhelm the short-term. Is that what you're saying?
That impact the authenticity of that sporting moment.
And it definitely makes the stakes feel lower when you don't actually – you're not compelled to actually fight each other. And in the case of Mayweather, it's been argued that he spent – the 5 years we talked about earlier, kind of ducking Pacquiao until you get to a point where it's a greatly diminished Pacquiao that he knows he can beat. And I think that's one of the big things in boxing is no organizing body is telling you have to, face off against this guy and it within the framework of a larger, tournament atmosphere or some kind of structure that leads to a championship. It's, do you feel like fighting this guy for this amount of money and to unify these belts, which, by the way, there are even this did not unify the championship in their weight class. There's another guy who has an alternate belt, I believe it's the IBF, that still doesn't belong to Mayweather. So I think boxing, it's just one of the big complaints is the organization seems to be very haphazard, and that has always been the way it is. But I think that's a flaw that you can pick out in the sport for sure.
Okay, so let's leave it there. We'll check back in 12 months when...
5 years.
Yeah, 12 months to 5 years when the 45-year-old Mayweather Pacquiao will
be... It will be like Rocky then.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. And now, a message from our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. You know the feeling. You're sitting there in the stadium looking at all the other people who are at the same game as you, wondering how much they paid for their tickets. It's the kind of doubt that can gnaw at somebody. They have what is essentially the same seat as you, but they may have gotten it for much less money. SeatGeek can help with that. It harnesses all sorts of data to give you a range of ticket prices, aggregating tickets from every major ticket site online, and taking into account historical ticket prices, the day of the week, who the opponent is, etc. This week you can use promo code TAKEDOWN on the SeatGeek app and get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is download the app, enter the promo code before you buy your tickets, and SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first purchase. Again, that's promo code TAKEDOWN. The SeatGeek app is your ticket to sports this April. So the second round of the NBA playoffs have begun. The final eight are with us. But before we dive into the second round, can we just for a second eulogize that Clips-Spurs series? Because it was really incredible. So friend of 538, Mike Bowie, who's written about NFL playoff odds for us and also has a lot of work done around what he calls the NBA excitement index. So how exciting are our games? He ran some numbers, and by his measure, which looks at the change in win probability, how crazy were the come from behind victories or in general the upsets. By his measure, The Spurs Clip series had three of the top five exciting games of the first round in just that one series. To me, no game was more exciting than that game seven. Chris Paul did his best Willis Reed impression and made the game-winning shot over the outstretched arms of Tim Duncan. To me, that was kind of – it was one of those moments that only – that the NBA is so good at manufacturing, which is star on star when, like, the game is on the line. And other sports don't always get to that because football has the quarterback and the defense and whatever else. And so immediately after the game, the hot take machine was already gearing up, wondering whether the Spurs dynasty was over.
You can't ask for anything more from a Game 7. It was terrific. So many great performances all around. And now the question looms, what happens to the San Antonio Spurs?
Yes.
Tim Duncan, obviously still one of the elite players we have in the NBA, still at 39 years old. What happens with this group, Greg Popovich and the like? Going to be interesting to see. But congrats to the Clippers, Doc Rivers, Steve Ballmer, only $2 million.
So when you look at this team versus other Spurs teams, they don't look so different. Their offensive rating, which is an estimate of points per 100 possessions or so, of this year's Spurs was basically the same as the 2012-2013 Spurs, who came within one Ray Allen shot of winning the finals. And so as you guys were watching, did you feel like this was a different Spurs team than other teams? And what does that mean for the Popoviches and Duncans or whoever is still on the team's legacy going forward?
No, not really. Just they ran into another really awesome team in the first round, and you can make arguments about why the NBA should do things to perhaps prevent that from being a first-round series and maybe have it happen later in some of the seedings and things that we talked about, I believe, a few weeks ago. But I saw no reason. Like, if you look at the regress to the mean versions of the stats for the players on the Spurs this year versus the championship team from last year, they were basically just as talented and played just as well this year as they did last year.
And not maybe put you on the spot, but what about Tony Parker? That's my one concern, is that he was one of their main cogs, and the way he played in their championship runs was well above what I saw from him in this postseason. Now, maybe it's just he's battling injuries, but is it possible that, I don't think the Spurs dynasty is over, but is it possible that they can make these same runs with a Tony Parker who may never be the same Tony Parker?
But weren't we saying a very similar thing about Manu Ginobili a couple years ago? I forget what year, but he looked so bad. I think it was the 2012-13 year that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. He looked just washed up. And then last year he came back and looked revived in the playoffs. So it could be just that as players get older, the variance in their performance might change along with opponents.
And not only that, but as Parker took a step back this year, Kawhi Leonard took a large step forward, so it sort of offsets itself, and that's what you'd expect. Parker's 32, Leonard's 23. They're crossing, the arcs of their career are crossing.
And that's part of what makes a dynasty, right, is you have these replacements is perhaps too strong a word, but people who come up and start taking some of the minutes or some of the points or some of the ownership of the team, and that's what presumably can create a multi-year legacy as opposed to just, you know, one set of players. There's a window and then it closes.
Right. I mean, it's tough to compare the NBA to the women's college basketball. That's what you have at UConn, right? You have young players who come in and the older players teach whatever the culture is. And that's totally what the Spurs feels like, what they have going. Of course, they draft Kawhi Leonard instead of Jimmer Fredette, right? I mean, Sacramento Kings take Jimmer Fredette instead of Kawhi Leonard, and I'm sure you could name other people in that draft. But the Spurs have drafted well. Now, whether that's they have some secret formula, which we don't think they have, or they just have made a number of really good picks. But I'm with Neil on this, in that watching them play against the Clippers, like, they looked no different to me than any Spurs team that has won the NBA championship. In fact, if they had gone a different route in the playoffs,
if they won that last game and got the 2 seed, maybe, as opposed to the 6 seed.
Exactly. I mean, you can see a different path, like, sort of like highlighting for them en route to another NBA championship. I mean, what I saw was them run into a Clippers team who finally just kind of, for lack of a better phrase, like, put their foot down about the fact that they were not going to be that same Clippers team again, and make the Spurs made play after play. And then the Clippers just made one more play. So I think it's a little bit soon to say, because Chris Paul hits, like, a runner off 1 foot that cleared Tim Duncan's hand by a millimeter, that means that the Spurs are done.
And I think some of the talk was also about speculation that their older players, specifically Tim Duncan, would retire, that had to do with people declaring them dead. But I think the word is that that's not going to happen. So they, if the numbers are any indication and if our eyes are any indication, they'll probably be back next year and we'll be talking about them same time.
And still trying to figure out whether or not one play or one game or whatever can somehow define an entire decade-long legacy. So let's talk about Chris Paul, because that was a crazy game by one athlete. And we've talked about this before on this podcast where – you know, where the numbers stop is when athletic accomplishment sort of seems to take over a little bit. And so, you know, what no spreadsheet's going to tell you 5 years from now when you're looking at Chris Paul's 2015 postseason performance is that he had a lame hamstring for all of games, for a deciding game in the first round of the playoffs. So wherever Chris, the Clippers end up this postseason, that sort of gets washed away from history. And yet, when we were watching it, that felt like the defining thing about that game. And so I wondered sort of, what is it about Chris Paul, do we think, that as we've watched him for 10 years now, that maybe defines him as a player that the stats can't capture? And the stats capture a lot. And
Yeah, I was going to say the first thing is that in some ways this win was a validation for him. He's always kind of been dogged by the fact that he hasn't had as much playoff success as you would expect. And one of the reasons you would expect a lot of playoff success is if you move down the list past LeBron, I'm not sure, like maybe Durant, especially in the past few years, but aside from those two guys, I'm not sure there's anyone who's been a better player in basketball over the span of his career than Chris Paul, and he doesn't really get brought up in that conversation consistently enough. There were even years where Dwight Howard was getting, you know, serious MVP consideration, and Chris Paul, throughout the rises and falls of a bunch of other players over the same span, has been there year in and year out, and the advanced stats say that he is one of the best players ever.
So Chris Paul has, in his 10-year career, three of those years he has had the most offensive win share. So on offense, he's contributed the most towards his team's wins of any player in the league. And in one year, in 2007-2008, he had the most win shares overall on both sides of the court. So it's clear that probably because of his assists as well as his point scoring, that he is just better. I mean, Kate, when you watch him, do you see a point guard that's different than the other style of point guard that are in the league right now? Because Westbrook and he seem like light years from one another.
Yeah, his style of play is very old school point guard in terms of passing first. And I did a story on the Clippers last year, and the thing that I watch a lot with Chris now is when Doc Rivers took over, Chris would often dribble the ball up the court. And Doc was like, you gotta pass the ball up the court, like, immediately. Mm-hmm. And when Chris started doing that, like, the Clippers went from, like, a fast-breaking team to a really efficient fast-breaking team. And you'll even see with Chris now passing it up court to Blake Griffin a lot, which was not something that happened a year and a half ago and I think really contributes to the Clippers offensively. And I think Chris Paul defensively is incredible. And I know there are metrics for that and how strong he is, and so much stronger in a lot of ways than Curry or Harden. Curry defensively gets shielded from being exposed because he's on a really, really good Golden State defensive team. But Chris Paul is good individually defensively, which I think sets him apart. I think the one thing that, and this is more of a personal sort of viewpoint, and I've heard this stated about other athletes, with Chris Paul, until his game-winning shot over Tim Duncan, he didn't have a lot of moments, which is not an analytic, it's not something you can quantify, but think back in his career and, like, name me a moment. And you can name LeBron moments. You know, you can name his game-winning shot in the playoffs. You know, you've got, like, the headband. You've got all these different things that sort of, like, add up to, along with the stats and the numbers, like, this idea of LeBron. And Chris didn't have any of those. In a lot of ways, in our minds, I think that plays in our minds, is when we think back on something and, like, what do we remember? And we could even, I'll go on a slight tangent here about, like, was Saturday the greatest sports day ever? Like, it's kind of, will it stand the test of time? Probably not, because, like, what moments other than Chris Paul's did we get from that? And we get certain moments
that
throughout.
That Burger King mascot coming out.
That's true. That was, like, that will stand the test of time, yeah, for
Justin
sure.
Bieber.
So for Chris, I think that he turned the corner with that small, immeasurable, with that
and
shot.
To your point of what plays in our mind, it also plays on ESPN and on the highlight
right.
shows or when he's inducted into the Hall of Fame, whatever else. And these spreadsheets won't be the thing that are played, right? Some stats will be listed, but we're not going to look at offensive win shares, and we're not going to look at his Game 7 efficiency rating. We're going to look at the Game 7 hamstring. And so let's just quickly touch on the second round. I know, Neil, you've been running some simulations about what's going on as the league shifts into this next round. As of this recording, all four series have played one game. And there have been a few more surprises than in round one. And Neil, you ran your simulations before these games were played. And what was the series that stuck out to you as being particularly one-sided or particularly tight?
Well, every series Golden State plays seems to be particularly one-sided according to the numbers, because our power ratings, which are, for people listening, they're based on the player ratings using this system called Real Plus Minus, which tries to tease out each player's contribution by looking at, like, multiple years of his career, who he played with, who he played against, and looking at how the team played when he was on the floor versus when he wasn't on the floor. And so we, not to toot our own horn, but we had the Warriors as one of the best team in basketball, certainly the best team in the West, going into the season, and they've blown away even that expectation all throughout the year, and they've had this historic year, 67 wins, and they've also had one of the best point differentials ever of any team in NBA history during the regular season, and that feeds into it. And then after their great first round performance, they are now, I believe, 67% likely to win the NBA championship according to this metric. The betting markets are still not as convinced, which I think is a little bit interesting, and it kind of speaks to this idea of, have the Warriors proven that they have this certain something that we think that NBA champions have? And I believe we talked about this in an earlier episode, of this idea of, if are you considered capable of winning it? Well, if you've won it before, then yes, and if not, then no. But how do you win it the first time if you're not capable and you don't have that championship pedigree? So some of it seems like a post hoc thing, where we don't believe a team really can win, especially one like you were talking about earlier, Kate, like the fast-paced team like the Warriors and the three-point shooting team. There's this sort of inherent skepticism to that style of play, but at the same time, they had this great season, and it just doesn't seem to be stopping anytime soon. They seem to be on a roll.
Yeah, the thing I heard all the time when I covered the Sixers, and they went to the playoffs a couple times, and, you know, they would go as like a 7 or 8 seed. One year they played the Orlando Magic with Dwight Howard, and the Sixers at that time were playing a really up and down pace. They had a lot of young guys like Thaddeus Young and Lou Williams and Iguodala, who were good in the open court. And all throughout the year, everybody would say, that's fine during the regular season, but they can't execute in the half court defensively or offensively. And they certainly can't, you know, at crunch time on a final play, be able to really precisely execute and score. Like, you know, if they were down one or something with 30 seconds left. And so when I looked at the Warriors-Grizzlies series, and Warriors at 94%, and yet the Grizzlies have all of these qualities that, like, very recently, 3-4 years ago, we said you have to have in the postseason, right? Like, solid half-court D, forcing turnovers, limiting total shots, like, precise half-court execution.
A guy with a broken face.
Facial fracture is always a key. But, like, the Memphis Grizzlies are, like, the prototype of what we thought we wanted in an NBA contender, and yet the Warriors throwing up lots of threes, and we always used to say, right, like, the three-point shooting's fine, but, you know, it comes and it goes. You never know what'll happen in the postseason. Right.
But maybe if you have singular talents like Thompson and Curry, then it only comes. It doesn't go.
Right, and we obviously can try and look at it objectively and be like, of course the Warriors can win, but there will still be vast amounts of people who are like, that style can't win because it hasn't won.
So I want to circle back to something that you mentioned a few minutes ago, Kate, which is this greatest sports day of the year thing. You had the Game 7 from the Spurs and Clippers. You had the Kentucky Derby. You had the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight. Am I missing any?
There's hockey. Capitals-Rangers game.
There might have been an Irish hurling match. I got an email today about Irish
hurling. I love Irish hurling. It's like field hockey in the air.
I have an infographic to share with you. And I'm sure you're right. There's, of course, hockey. So a reader emailed us asking if we could somehow quantify, or maybe it was a listener, I forget, if we could somehow quantify the greatest sports day of all time. And we were thinking about maybe doing it, but when we couldn't figure out quite how to do it. But I wondered what metrics you guys would throw in if you had to somehow do this. Like, what are you looking for? Does it matter how many people are watching? Does it matter whether something exciting happened? Mm-hmm. I talked earlier about this NBA excitement index, that there was an upset, or that there was a lot of hype in the Mayweather-Pacquiao case. What
And does it matter the popularity mm-hmm. of the sports? Because, like, Kentucky Derby and boxing, sure, but the popularity of those sports aren't that high. And was it like,
unless the year is 1930.
Right, and then we can all go to a bar and it's prohibition. And
because theoretically, a day where there's one sporting event, let's say a great Super Bowl, should, I think, be able to overwhelm a day with four really good sporting events? Or no, is it about the quantity and having so much packed in?
Maybe the diversity matters. Mm. Many different sports in action at the same time with some type of meaningful stakes on the line. But that's the part that I don't really buy about this past Saturday, is that was there that much at stake? The Clippers Spurs, there was certainly a lot at stake. But when we talked about the boxing match, we talked about how they didn't really even seem to have that sense of urgency that you would expect to have out of people that were really fighting for the championship of the sport that they're involved in. And the same goes the Kentucky Derby. It's really the first leg of what we're hoping for, a Triple Crown. At least that's what I'm rooting to see in my lifetime. And even that has been a little bit of a tease in recent years. And there was a piece that ran on our own site about how difficult it is that even if you win the first two legs of the Triple Crown, that the third one is so much longer than the other two that you have to almost have a different horse now, a specialized horse, and that makes the Triple Crown, which this Kentucky Derby is just one component of, sort of not in the realm of possibility as much anymore.
So let's leave it there and start talking about baseball, guys.
Yay!
So last week, three guys at Baseball Prospectus tried to topple a giant. They unveiled something called DRA, deserved run average, as an alternative to the stat we all know, ERA, earned run average. And we're inundated with stats these days, obviously, but it's rare, at least for me, to watch a stat be born in the wild. And so here with us is one of DRA's proud parents, Harry Pavlidis, to talk about his creation and sort of how it came about. Harry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So sketch out for us what DRA is and how it's different than ERA, which is probably the thing that we're most used to hearing about.
Well, I mean, ERA is just, you know, what very, very basic accounting of what happened on the field without any regard to quality competition, the environment, the stadium, any other factor that may influence scoring. And it also has, you know, no concern for the vagaries of defense and batted ball behavior. And, you know, it doesn't really seem to differentiate between earned runs. It does differentiate, between earned runs and unearned runs, which is kind of strange because it's like, well, let's pretend you didn't get, you know, give up those two hits after the error. You still did that. So you're still on the hook for something. So what we try to look for at Baseball Prospectus was, what does the pitcher deserve to be charged with? Or accredited with in the game of baseball? And it's a tricky question because some of these, you know, list of factors I just rattled off. But using some kind of sophisticated modeling techniques that we first started using on a simpler, quote-unquote, simpler problem of a catching analysis, we found that we were able to come up with a way of describing what the pitcher should be credited for during a season, considering who their catchers were, who the batters were, who the umpires were, what the weather was like, what the ballpark was, who was on base and when, and what jams did they get out of. And it's, you know, comes out to change a few, you know, pictures of guys that we thought we may have understood better in the past, and now we kind of have a new perspective on them. And it's also confirming some of the things we know, you know, like Pedro Martinez was very good and borders on breaking the system. So that means, by the way, Pedro Martinez circa 1999-2000 breaks your pitching metric might be correct.
Right. So this sounds like kind of a grand unifying theory of pitching stats. Can you talk a little bit about how this compares to sort of the evolutionary stats before, like FIP, fielding independent pitching, or Sierra, or any of the other sort of precursors to this?
Basically, you know, FIP is a very popular metric. It does a good job, I think, of controlling for eliminating, really, not controlling for, but eliminating a lot of things that pitchers' responsibility for is kind of murky. At the same time, it gives them full credit or blame for home runs, which they actually have less control over, you know, how many fly balls turn into home runs than they do how many pitches turn into fly balls. So there's some kind of weird things about FIP, and it may have some good predictive power. But our colleague Jonathan Judge created something called CFIP, which is contextual FIP. And
these acronyms are just incredible.
Yeah, which is, you know, we use that as kind of the baseline. It's kind of a control for DRA. And then try to find, you know, the gaps between what that does, which is still throws away a lot of batted ball information, and try to bring that back in and try to take out the defensive independentness as opposed to just assuming it should be thrown away, but rather trying to control for all the different actors. And you really can't do that unless you use these advanced modeling techniques, which from my perspective as director of technology, it was all about finding someone who could do it and do it in a baseball environment. And so, that turned out to be Jonathan.
So Harry, can you hear me? This is
Kate. Yeah, definitely.
I see in reading the piece that a lot of pitchers that we thought were great are confirmed as great or possibly even better than we thought, like Pedro Martinez. Were there any results or pitchers who you were surprised at what their DRA ended up being, that maybe they aren't as good as we thought, or maybe there are any pitchers who we thought who are better than we thought?
Some guys who popped up as being better, like Jason Schmidt, 2003-2004, put up incredible seasons. And those are ones we're looking at to make sure there's nothing, you know, strange about them. But he gets more credit with DRA than he did with typical pitching metrics. We also looked. It looks like Jack Morris may have been better than we thought, which we're still looking at some of the ins and outs of historical data. But it might turn out that, you know, DRA would have been Jack's friend. That was a little bit surprising. But in the contemporary side, Dallas Keuchel is a guy who, it right now, is about number one in the league, and he seems to be a guy who is beating his batted ball. You know, he's beating CFIP by quite a bit, but he also did that last year, it looks like, too. So he seems to be someone who's getting a much better shake, you know, out of DRA than the FIP metrics have given him.
Now, I know in the past a lot of the pitching stats have either fallen into the camp of giving people credit retroactively and kind of looking backwards versus being predictive going forward. Would you say which camp does DRA fall into, or does it sort of try to do bits of both?
It ends up having utility in both, but its primary objective is to be descriptive. And that's really because at Baseball Prospectus we do a projection system, which you guys may be familiar with the guy who started the Pacoda projection system some years ago. Nate Silver, I think. Yeah. So Pacoda is where we want to put our futures into.
Harry, can you quantify for me how many hours you spent doing this?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's a lot of people involved. I mean, so there was Jonathan, myself, Dan Turkenkopf, who was the other author, but also, you know, your colleague Rob Arthur, still kind of hangs around in the weeds at BP, and some, you know, Russell Carlton looked in on this. We had some outside reviewers.
But we're trying to get, like, what possesses
hundreds,
what?
Yeah. I had a guess, man hours total. It's in the order of hundreds.
What motivates you to spend that many hours doing something that an uncharitable person, I'm not sure that we are those people, but an uncharitable person would say is trivia? Well, you know, that you're just trying to sort of, like,
well,
be able to.
No, it might be trivia to some, but we find we can actually make a living doing it. So, you know, we do it. It's, if you pay me to climb the mountain, I'm much more likely to climb it. But we do it anyways. I mean, I started my foray into the baseball business by charting every pitch that's tracked by PitchFX. I mean, in my time now, I've done over 10 million pitches. Working, you know, and, you know, with public and private data sets. So I'm not the right person to ask about, like, hey, why would you spend so much time? Because this is all, you know, all I do is work on baseball stuff and baseball data.
Do you have a routine while you do it?
We wanted to make sure we had the best pitching stat available. We were also curious about how we can apply some of these advanced modeling techniques that we were working on. Because, you know, to squeeze more signal out of the noise, which is, that may ring a bell to you guys too, you do have to at some point accept that there's some level of complexity and embrace it. and find a way to do it. And find, so basically for me, it was creating a team of people in an environment that, you know, we could take on a challenge like this. And we just got excited about it.
Okay, Harry, thanks again for coming on. And everyone can check out Harry and his colleagues' work at Baseball Prospectus. And this is something that's not behind the paywall, right, Harry? Anyone can come and look at it?
Absolutely. It's the sortable stats. You know, if you just go our statistics and it's advanced pitching stats, it's right there. And the articles explaining it, they're all, you know, right outside, free for anyone to come and read.
Great. And the link, of course, will be on 538.com on the show page for Hot Takedown. Thanks again, Harry.
Thank you.
Okay, now for our significant digit, the one, the only, Allison McCann has walked through the door. Allison, welcome back.
Hey, Chad.
What do you got today?
This week's significant digit comes to us from The Guardian, in spirit of a Champions League this week, and it is 0.43, which is the number of goals conceded per game for Bayern Munich. Pep Guardiola's new team, I guess, second year with this team. And anyway, as of Saturday, they had conceded just 13 goals in 30 games. They won the Bundesliga, and this is the best, I guess, goals conceded per game of Pep's career, which is sort of an interesting stat, I think, especially given the Bayern and Barcelona matchup. People have been really questioning what's it going to take for Pep to have this same sort of reign with Bayern. You know, they didn't do so well last year, and he had this amazing career with his former team that he'll play again tomorrow. And, you know, maybe he hadn't heard this figure yet, that his team is faring well, especially on defense, which will prove very important.
And didn't he doubt his team's chances against Barca?
He actually said today in an interview that there's no defense that can stop Messi. It is impossible, and Messi being impossible is one of our favorite topics to cover.
When you say that's a 538 thing, what have you come up with about Messi, quote-unquote, being impossible?
Well, our colleague Ben Morris had a litany of stats that he laid out in an article during the World Cup last year, in which, like, you could basically pick any sort of offensive stat that you want individually, like, you know, scores from certain distances, just
dribbling by a defender, as well as sort of touch passes that led to goals, like everything that was actually productive in a soccer match on offense.
Yeah, he's like, not only is he the best at it, but he like blows away everyone else in the world at it by like many, many standard deviations. And that's why he's considered to be impossible. And Guardiola would know more than anyone else how impossible he is, since he coached him for so many years.
Yeah, that's sort of what I thought. Like, if anyone is going to be able to defeat Barcelona and Messi, it's probably someone that did spend 4 years watching him play, right?
My favorite thing about Messi, and now, shoot, I might butcher this, but I believe his nickname is The Flea, because mm-hmm. he's so small, and that's just such a great sports nickname that I think more athletes should be embracing.
But it does seem like 0.43, maybe that's the existing number, but like, that's not the number against Barcelona and Messi, right? So it's kind of like you're coming from this place of like, it seems like Bayern Munich should be in a position to be able to beat Barcelona, but perhaps that statistic means nothing when you're talking about this guy who blows all other statistics out of the water, at least one of the players on that team.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, the betting markets have Barcelona favored in the rematch. But it is
maybe Pep's got some
Barcelona
money down on the match.
What's the line? Are they like Golden State Warrior favorites here?
Maybe not. 3-4 odds for them to win.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate too that Bayern statistic might have come from a place in which like half of their back line was also uninjured, so that will be a telling tomorrow. I think
they will be injured.
Yeah, they have about like two or three of their usual starting defenders, which is not to say the people coming off the bench are, you know, also incredible soccer players, but anyway, it'll be super interesting to see how 0.43 holds up tomorrow in their matchup.
Great, so tune in tomorrow to that match, and thanks Allison, as always, for the significant digit.
Thanks for having me.
So that'll do it for this week's show. Our producer is Jody Avergan. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. You can find Hot Takedown on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538 if you're coming to us fresh. While you're there, whether you are a new subscriber or not, please be sure to review and rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Thanks, as always, to Kate Fagan, ESPNW's Kate Fagan. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Chad.
538's Neil Payne.
Thank you, Chad.
I'm Chad McMatlin. Talk to you next time.